aspects of fate in the Mahabharata, and the introduction will consist in just explaining these words in a way, but in reverse order. You have an overview of the table of contents, if you will, on the handout. I hope everybody has a handout. Okay, so first I will say a few general things about our text, the Mahabharata. Secondly, some methodological considerations will follow on the question what it may mean that something is in the Mahabharata. And lastly, I shall explain my approach to the concept of fate. You will notice in a minute that a rather large amount of methodological questions will be touched upon. This is unavoidable, I think, if we want to tackle the present task in a scholarly and transparent manner. But I hope the following considerations may also be interesting beyond that scope, because similar problems appear in other anonymous textual traditions as well. So, first question, what is the Mahabharata? First of all, it is a text of gigantic dimensions, of more than, in the critical edition, of more than 150,000 lines in 18 books. That is, for example, more than 10 times the size of the Iliad. Usually, it is qualified as an epic, but besides a basic plot of the kind that can be expected of a heroic epic, and I'll come back to it in a second, it contains very numerous additional stories and many, many large passages, indeed whole books of a so-called didactic nature. So it means philosophical or theological, mainly, nature. And these books occupy as much space as the story. In this way, the whole text gains a kind of encyclopedic character, and it claims itself in an oft-quoted verse, "What is here on law, profit, pleasure, and liberation, O bull of the Bharata race, that is elsewhere also. What is not here is nowhere else." So it means what is here in the Mahabharata, law, profit, pleasure, and liberation are the classic four aims of human life. So everything of human life should be included in the Mahabharata, and it should be comprehensive. This is maybe a little exaggerated, but nevertheless, in view of this, it is clear that I cannot give an exhaustive account of the whole work here. And even of the main plot, which is quite complicated, I will tell you only so much as is necessary to understand the basic conflict, and I will try to minimize the number of Sanskrit names, because I have more than once made the quite frustrating experience that the very names sometimes are enough to discourage some listeners. At the root of the plot lies a complicated problem of succession. You have a simplified scheme on the handout and here also on the screen. And the names that will appear again later are in bold type. Here not, but on your handout, I hope you can distinguish them. Basically, as you see, there are two conflicting lines deriving from the two brothers, Pandu and Dhritarashtra, respectively. Pandu dies quite early, and Dhritarashtra takes over the kingdom, though he's blind, so in normal circumstances he would not be able to be king. Now the question is, who is going to be the successor? In normal circumstances it should be the eldest brother, which is Yudhishthira. But, well, this situation is complicated, and so they have to work out some other way to solve the problem. First, they both parties agree on a partition of the land, but then, after some time, Duryodhana, the bad guy, becomes jealous of his cousin Yudhishthira's success and challenges him to a dicing game, which he wins. We will come back to that game later on also. The outcome of the game means, among other things, an exile of 13 years for the Pandavas. The Pandavas are these five brothers, the descendants of Pandu, after which the former petition is to be renewed. But when the five brothers luckily return from exile, in spite of different attempts by Duryodhana to get rid of them once and for all by different means, the latter does not want to return their share of land. So there ensues an apocalyptic war that the Pandavas eventually win. but the price is immense. They are almost the only survivors of the carnage. And I will spare you the details of the 18-day-long battle that rages over some 40,000 lines in the epic. Only one important information: the most valuable ally of the five brothers proves to be a certain Krishna, king of the Vrishnis, who happens to be an incarnation of Vishnu, the highest god. The question of Krishna's identity is quite tricky and much discussed. So was he conceived of as a god from the very beginning, or did he obtain the status only during the development of the text? If the latter, when and how? I have to leave this discussion aside, but we'll return to Krishna at the end of this talk. The epic basically ends with a war and its immediate aftermath. In some concluding chapters, it is narrated how the surviving heroes find their end, the last of which is Yudhishthira, who ascends to heaven and meets his whole family there. After this very short summary of the main events, we must address the structure of the work. So what can it mean that some notion, like fate in our case, is in the Mahabharata? This seemingly simple question leads to major problems that have to be addressed a little more in depth. The answer would only then be comparatively easy if we could accept, with the Indian tradition, the Mahabharata as a unified text. This, however, is difficult for most scholars who take issues of textual history seriously, because many indications point to a long and variegated history of the text, or better, texts we are dealing with. To present the situation in a transparent manner, it is convenient first to talk about the critical edition, then about questions of textual history that go beyond it. I'm sure you're all well informed about the usual procedure for establishing a critical edition of a text. First, one has to collect all relevant manuscripts, then collate them, construct a stemma codicorum, and finally to reconstruct a text that comes as close to the archetype of our manuscripts as possible. This method can, however, only partially be applied to the Mahabharata, for in this case we have to do, well, for some reasons, but the main reason is that in this case we have to do with a whole tradition of different versions rather than with variations of one text and one manuscript originally. Nevertheless, the Herculean task of establishing a critical text has been undertaken by a group of scholars, most of them Indians, which is quite remarkable, and the task was completed in the early 1960s after some 30 years of intense work. The general strategy of the editors was to find the common verses of the two main groups of manuscripts and traditions that apparently had developed largely independently over several centuries. So please have a look at this extremely simplified scheme. Here you see that we have two main groups of manuscripts: northern manuscripts, southern manuscripts, and the intersection, as it were, is the critical edition. This is, of course, very, very, very simplified. Here you can see at once that the critical edition is much smaller than the multitude of verses found in any of the two groups, let alone both groups combined. So the first decision every interpreter of the Mahabharata has to take, how he defines the scope of his research. One school of Mahabharata scholarship chooses to take into account the whole tradition, so both circles, as it were, every text that's some part of the Mahabharata, seeing it as one large mythical structure, and consequently ignoring most spatial and chronological differences between the versions and verses. This tends to lead to very interesting, but I feel sometimes rather fanciful interpretations. Anyway, it is not the approach I'm taking today, so I will stick to the critical edition. So this smaller part, which still is large enough. But this only brings us to the next fundamental decision. For if we have a closer look at the text of the critical edition, there are many quite obvious linguistic differences of style, of meter, for example. We have repetitions in it, we have contradictions, and so on. And all that strongly suggests that this text also is not monolithic, but the product of a growth that probably lasted for a longer time. If it would be possible to distinguish all the layers of this growth process, the result would look somewhat like this. Only much, much, much more complicated. So this is also a very, very schematic version, just to show the principle, how that could work out. So in this case, we have a chronological sequence of different layers. Chronologically, we have blue, orange, red, and green layers. But if we go through the text, we see that in this scheme, the blue layers, the oldest layers, are more or less the center. Then we have different kinds of insertions. We have insertions that just occur at one point of the text. We have others that occur simultaneously at two points. And we have others that are added in a kind of bracket-like fashion, the green ones here, so that the whole thing forms a kind of ring composition. And indeed, it has been one of the main endeavors of Mahabharata scholarship in the West for well more than a century to identify layers of that kind. Unfortunately, one has to admit that everything that might have happened in the time before our oldest manuscripts can only be reconstructed by relying on internal textual evidence, which tends to be much less conclusive than relations of manuscripts. So the results of these investigations are not so unanimous and clear as one would wish, but this is certainly no reason to give up this kind of research altogether, as some colleagues suggest, but rather to develop better, more objective methods. Some of these methods will be part of my account, and I shall present them shortly. Just one word on chronology. You might be a little astonished that I have not given any fixed date so far of this text. But this is the usual situation with anonymous Sanskrit literature, and even with other parts of Sanskrit literature, unfortunately, where we mostly can only establish a relative chronology and give very vague and tentative absolute dates. In the case of the Mahabharata, most scholars assume that the formation process started in about the 4th century BCE, so that would be the blue layers here, and largely came to an end as late as in the 4th century CE, so which adds up to almost a millennium of textual history, even before the manuscript tradition started. Yeah, we have almost a millennium of textual history that we can only reconstruct partially by internal evidence, and then we have a whole another millennium and more of manuscript history where we can, of course, work in a better way, but still. We have to take both things together. Okay, now it's time to gradually become more concrete. So the first question, what does all that mean for conceptual studies like this one? In the case of the notion of fate, like probably with most complex concepts, the text offers a plurality of aspects so that the investigator has to ask himself how to organize the evidence. This decision is, of course, closely connected to the way the structure of the text is understood. If the Mahabharata is viewed as the end product of an organic, uncontrolled, even chaotic growth, as many scholars in the late 19th and early 20th century believed, there are two possible solutions. The easiest way would be a paratectic juxtaposition of all aspects that we find. Alternatively, one could also try to bring the attested positions in historical and or logical order. If, on the other hand, the Mahabharata is first of all seen as a purposely composed whole, which includes the possibility that there are layers, if the layers were put in their place by a redactor or a group of redactors with a plan in mind, then a hypotectic account should be the best solution. That is, using one aspect, the highest one from the point of view of the author or the redactor, as a vantage point from which all other notions of fate are judged and arranged. Now, I will not try to give such a unified hypotectic account here, and for this I have two reasons. Firstly, the reconstruction of the position of an alleged final redactor is fraught with so many uncertainties, in my view, that a falsification of the result becomes nearly impossible. So it may be interesting, but it's maybe not entirely scientific. Secondly, assuming the viewpoint of a late redactor implies a rather forced interpretation of a great many passages that have to be read in disregard of their original context in order to fit his needs. In view of these arguments, I find it more worthwhile to pay attention to diversity in texts and traditions, and this goal is better served by an approach that treats the different notions of fate in their own right, though I will also try, but only in a second step, to show some logical but not necessary historical connections between them. My way of arranging the material makes use of some methods that are specifically related to certain particularities of the epic language. As this kind of approach is almost completely lacking in the existing conceptual studies of the Mahabharata, I hope to be able to add few insights. But first, I must at least briefly explain which particularities I have in mind here. Speaking of the epic language, or epic Sanskrit, as it is sometimes called, it is important to understand that it is something more than just one among many stylistic variants of Sanskrit. This is due to the fact that the origin of the Sanskrit epics, and therefore also of their particular language, lies in oral poetry. That means, in turn, that the first epic poems in Sanskrit were the results of improvised performances of specialized bards. And as we know from parallel phenomena in many other times and cultures, this kind of improvisation requires a large set of more or less flexible formulaic expressions that enable the poet to perform under the double pressure of time and metrical requirements. These formulaic elements have a fixed metrical structure and therefore are restricted to certain metrical positions in the verse, often to one position only. To just give you one example, but only very quickly, so this is a small program I wrote to have a look at these things. You can forget about almost all of it, because most information are not important now. The only important information are here in the right and left hand side. So-called shloka, so the bread and butter meter of the Sanskrit epics, has 16 syllables. And now I counted, if I look at a certain formula, in this case, kalena maata, so in a long time. I look where this formula starts. It may start theoretically in different positions, but as you see, it starts mainly in the first syllable, in the third syllable, or the ninth syllable. And for several reasons, these cases are almost identical. So in fact, from all the possibilities, it starts only in two positions. So this means, I call this polarization. It means that this formula is almost exclusively found there. Sometimes you have it only in one metrical position, sometimes you have a greater plurality. This, you have to check this for every formula that you will do research on, and sometimes the results are quite revealing, I found. Now, a minute ago I said that the origins of the Sanskrit epics lie in oral poetry. But please note, I did not claim that the Mahabharata was oral poetry. This is one more of these notoriously difficult questions of Mahabharata scholarship. Here is not the place to go into technical details, so I can only state my own position, which is rather mainstream, I think. The Mahabharata contains some passages, especially in the so-called battle books, that are written fixations of improvised oral compositions, but most of it was composed in a different way. So maybe orally, but not improvised or written. Though, but this is important, still on the basis of the established epic language and by and large in accordance with the traditional oral style. The considerations just presented form the background of the strategy I employed for tracing the notion of fate. It can be put into two points. In our case, formulaic stereotyped phrases or parts of phrases are not uninteresting, as they are usually concerned in normal literature, where we are looking rather for what is original or new. Quite on the contrary, they form the basic material of the epic language and so preserve to a certain extent the Weltanschauung of the bards, so the epic worldview, if you will. But that does not mean that the epic language cannot be used to express ideas that ideas not present in this epic worldview. But it is difficult. And this means, and this is the most important point, often such non-standard ideas will be detectable by their deviation from the standard forms, most importantly from the standard metrical forms. So in this case, well, this is not an example for this, but sometimes we have the case that almost all of the occurrences of one formula look like this, and then we have one or two instances where it occurs in a totally different metrical position, and this is, well, it is no proof, but it may be an indication that these verses where those formulas or these metrical positions occur are, as it were, maybe later or at least non-standard verses. Okay, so if we assume with the majority of the researchers that the original core of the Mahabharata consists of a heroic epic, it is hardly surprising that the percentage of deviations from the standard is much higher in the so-called didactic passages. Therefore, I choose the more traditional narrative passages as my starting point. More specifically, highly formalized phrases found there, and I will approach more philosophical usages only afterwards from that point of view. And without entering into philosophical or theological debates proper, because this would require an own lecture or even a series of lectures. Now, before we can come at long last to the text itself, just a few words must be said about the central notion we are dealing with, fate. In cases like this, where we use a Western notion to approach a non-Western text, I generally believe it is best not to start with rigid definitions, but to assume that the conceptual region, as it were, we are dealing with is reasonably well known, and then look closely at the relevant textual passages, finally construct the conceptual space from within, so to speak. So to first roughly demarcate the region by way of words, here's a list of sensory terms that are of special interest for our topic, so that are often translated also as fate, but not necessarily. And of course, I give only the most important ones because Sanskrit has very, very, very many words. But here, fortunately, the important ones, this number is rather small. You have this also on your handout. I would just comment on them briefly. First one, daiva, is a neuter noun, often translated as fate. Literal translation would be the divine. So it is derived from the word deva, which means God, and is related to Latin deus. Then we have dishta, also translated as fate, literally what is ordained. It's from the root dish, to show, to command, that is related to several verbs in European languages like Greek, deknimi, teach, or zeigen. Thirdly, we have kala, masculine, normally translated as time, but also meaning time with a capital T, or fate, or death. Then two masculine nouns also, very closely connected, datr and vidatr, coming from verbs, da to place, or vida to ordain, so meaning literally the placer and the ordainer. The number of passages containing one or more of these terms is considerable, which shows in itself that we have to do with a topic that is important for the indigenous tradition. Nevertheless, there is comparatively little literature to be found, secondary literature, I mean. Only in the last decade, two monographs have appeared, one from a Unitarian perspective and the other one very useful, mainly presenting ordered material. But there is no standard work yet. So now we can leave the preliminary considerations and look at what the text has to offer. According to the strategy just sketched, I begin with highly stereotyped passages where some of the mentioned words occur. Let us start with the words daiva and dishta, that are very often, well, used in almost exactly the same way, but not to 100%. So now please have a look at passage number one. It's the reverse page of your handout. I just read the English. Fate, methinks, reigns supreme. Fate is Daiva here. And man's acts are meaningless. Here in the following versions of, I gave the versions of several different translators. I think this is preferable to a terminologically standardized rendering by me because it shows also different possible terminological decisions that have been made and can be made. When we have a closer look at the occurrences of that phrase and at some two dozens of closely similar ones where the second half is lacking, so only the first one is fate reigns supreme or something like that, we find that they are typically used in two types of situations, and I'm tempted to use the German phrase Sitz im Leben here. So these situations are kind of prototypical real-life situations where those expressions are used. Of course, real life means real epic life. The first relates to the past. Some incredible catastrophe has just happened. Most often a great hero has fallen, which is almost unbelievable. Then this may be an expression of desperation, but more often the aim is to console somebody about the tragedy or to relieve the bad conscience of the one who caused it by mistaken decisions. Secondly, it may relate to the future, where some disastrous event is bound to happen, and in this case the phrase expresses the conviction that any further resistance is useless. An example of this you have in number two. There shall be a grisly and gruesome holocaust of man. It is fated, I think, and cannot be averted. This is Yudhishthira speaking, so, and the thing he really wants to say is, so now let's prepare for that war. We can't avoid it anymore, we have to face it. In spite of the fact that he is a very strong opponent of the war, he would like to make peace with his brother, but it turns out to be impossible. In these examples, Daiva, but also Dishta in some of the variants, emerges as the force that is responsible for the fact that something happened in spite of all human expectations, preparations, and efforts. Or, as the second user chose, more generally, the force that overrides all human initiatives if they go in the wrong direction. The wrong direction is, of course, the direction opposed to fate. Before we leave these two words, I would like to underscore the nice parallelism in the quoted passage number one. The Sanskrit word translated as man's acts here is the neuter noun paurusha. It is derived from the word purusha, man. By an exactly parallel uplaut formation, so-called vritti, as daiva is from deva. So we have deva, daiva, purusha, paurusha. This points to an intimate connection of the human and divine sphere at their very root. These two words form a complementary pair with the human sphere as fundamental notion. What can be controlled and achieved by humans is paurusha. Anything beyond its limits is daiva. The second word we now turn to, kala, originally denotes time. The etymology is unclear. At least it's not important in this way, in this case. In the Mahabharata, time is not conceived of according to the modern metaphor in the way of an immovable space in which things just happen without interacting with it, but rather as something like a medium, as water or air, that changes everything that moves through it and that can be of better or worse quality depending on the world age we have, the yuga. It is logical, therefore, that the tallness, longevity, health, etc. of human beings in better world ages than ours, which is, of course, the worst, as you all know probably, is attributed to a quality of time, as if time would be something like healthy air or something like that. So we live in bad air, and therefore we live only 70, 80 years and not 800 years, like people in former world ages. Sometimes kala is also said to bake or to ripen the beings, like heat. This interaction, as it were, of time with the things of the world leads directly to the idea of time as an actor. So that would be time with a capital T, the equivalent of fate. And because, in a certain sense at least, and because in the long run everybody dies, kala can also denote personified death. When we now look at the large number of formulaic expressions containing the word kala, that's about 250 with some 1,000 occurrences, we can notice that only a small part of them, about 10 with 30 occurrences, refer to time with a capital T. And they can be divided into three groups. Quite often, persons are said to be prompted by time, kala chodita in Sanskrit, when they take fatal decisions, especially such that lead to their own death. This usage can be understood in a similar way as the examples with daiva. In purely human terms, certain extremely imprudent or even foolish decisions would be unexplainable, so there must be some other force at work. This interpretation is strengthened by the fact that instead of kala, we occasionally also find daiva or the gods as prompting agents. And now just a small remark on the margin. By browsing several dictionaries for their renderings of words connected to fate, Sanskrit words connected to fate, I found an interesting case, at least I found it interesting. A very respected Indian lexicographer gives for kala chodita, well, literally prompted by time, the English equivalent summoned by the angel of death. And this is quite ingenious, I must say, but it also shows the dangers of intercultural translation very clearly, I think. Also, the adjective duratikrama, literally difficult to overcome, that is often combined with kala, links kala to daiva and dishta. Kala is a force that is too strong for human effort. And also, daiva and dishta are sometimes said to be strong or unsurmountable. We have them in one verse, number 3 on your handout, where it said, a task thought out one way happens in another. Ah, fate is powerful and destiny impossible to overcome. So here the translator chose to translate the second part of the verse, daivam as fate, and kala he chose to translate by destiny. Thirdly, in several instances, the law of time, kala dharman, is invoked in a formulaic way when somebody dies, especially in a peaceful and natural way. So much for some of the more important formulaic expressions. As you see, they are not particularly sophisticated, but still they presuppose a certain level of abstract thinking about questions of fate that already must have been common intellectual property at the time it became petrified in formulaic expressions. So this is a kind of archaeology, one could say, one can do by analyzing these expressions. Let us now slowly move away from this kind of evidence and look at passages mainly in the narrative, not in the didactic part of the epic, that explicitly reflect upon questions of fate. Starting this time with kala, it is possible to detect traces of a doctrine in the Mahabharata that is usually called kalavada, so literally doctrine of time, a time with a capital T, and can briefly be summarized in the following way, and I quote here Russian scholar, colleague Vasilkov, who is one of the few scholars who have devoted attention to this topic of kalavada. He summarizes it as follows. Time, termed the highest god, Parameshvara, which obeys only its inherent nature, Svabhava, caused only by itself, creates the world, ensures its function, a change of seasons, etc., and then destroys it. End of quote. It is not clear whether this doctrine, which can certainly be classified as a variant of fatalism, belongs to the core of the epic Weltanschauung, or if it entered later from other circles, but at least it is present. Another approach to fate consists in personification. There are various degrees and types of personification of fate. I want to deal only with one type where fate is neither completely impersonal nor is it considered as the will of one of the great individualized gods, that is either Vishnu or Shiva. Especially I have in mind passages where the decrees of fate are attributed to a divine instance called Datra, the placer, or Vidatra, the ordainer, we had on this list. No, we have it. As the names show, this god, so the Datra or Vidatra, is merely a personified function. So that one over, maybe should say, that the formation is goes like that. We have a root, da, in this case, and then we have the suffix tr, which is the same as in Latin tor, or in Greek also tor, for like in English loan words, for example, ektor. So this is the same thing. So this is just a very transparent formation from the root. So that's just a person, or, well, God in this case, who is connected with this action, so with da in this case. So one may be inclined to ask, if he has no individual personality, is there any real difference to the notion of impersonal fate at all? Well, indirectly, the Mahabharata gives us at least one, perhaps a little surprising answer to this question. Even a superficial personification of fate, like this one, opens up the possibility of criticizing the God that can now be made responsible for the many unjust things that tend to happen on earth. A critique of this kind is launched by Draupadi, the Pandava's spirited wife, when she witnesses her husband's plight after the dicing game. So please don't be shocked at that point. This case is very special, especially in Indian terms, but we have a situation here where we have one wife and five husbands. And this is only one of the many interesting details of the Mahabharata. So Draupadi is the wife of all the five brothers. I left her out of the scheme because I did not want to add more names, but so she's the wife of this group of five. So I'm quoting a little more from her angry speech in Yudhishthira's presence, because it is an emotionally powerful and, I think, beautiful, in a way, a piece of literature. She says, it is the Lord Placer alone, it's number four, the Lord Placer alone who sets down everything for the creatures, happiness and unhappiness, pleasure and sorrow, before even ejaculating the seed. These creatures, hero among men, are like wooden puppets that are manipulated. He makes body and limbs move. Joining and unjoining them, the capricious blessed Lord plays with the creatures like a child with its toys. The placer does not act towards the creatures like a father or mother. He seems to act out of fury like every other person. Having witnessed your distress and the wealth of Duryodhana's, I condemn the placer, Partha, who allows such outrages. This is quite a long speech, so I made it short here. And this is certainly a strong speech also. In reaction to this outburst, Draupadi's sober and very calm husband Yudhishthira tells her that she must not scold gods, and he tries to explain to her that one just have to believe that gods, that good deeds sooner or later will yield adequate results. And indeed, he succeeds, because she does not continue the discussion. But this can hardly erase the impression, I would say, the impression the Queen's speech makes. So Draupadi's cry, j'accuse, remains part of the Mahabharata. A third direction of philosophical thinking takes up the theme that emerged in the first set of formulaic expressions I just presented, the connection between fate and human effort, which is mostly Paurusha, but there are also other words like Purushakara. Indeed, but every always the noun man appears there. Indeed, the relationship of these two factors in bringing about effects in the world is discussed in more than one place, and all principal possibilities find their advocates. So we have radical fatalism, we have the extolment of human effort, and we have an equal combination of both factors. One could be tempted to view this as a debate about human freedom, but this seems rather mistaken to me, at least as far as modern notions of freedom are concerned. Here there is no question of freedom to act or to decide, rather of freedom to achieve, so to speak, because it is never denied that one may act to prevent a fated event, but it often is denied that such actions can be successful. As an expression of fatalism, one can deduce sentence number one, and in a certain sense also Draupadi's position. And similar utterances also occur very often in philosophical contexts. The counterposition appears, so the extolment of human effort appears among others, not so often, but still in a couple of passages, among others in the Didactic 12th book, where the old and wise warrior Bhishma explains to Yudhishthira the duties of a king. A king should always act energetically, says Bhishma, and may not trust in fate, Daiva is the word he uses, alone. And then we have number 5. These two things, extra human factors and energetic human effort, are part of all endeavors. But I think human effort is the more important of them. It is said that extra human agency must be determined by careful examination. It is not entirely clear what the last sentence is supposed to mean. But well, on the other hand, this is probably the most interesting part of this text. Perhaps it may be understood as an allusion to prognostic practices, specialized prognostic practices, but I rather think that Bhishma wants to underscore the fact that the human part in a specific event is rather obvious, whereas the extra human part, to use Fitzgerald's term here, so this is daiva, he translates daiva as extra human factor, the extra human part must be determined by deduction, so in a secondary hypothetical manner, and so is not so clear, not so clearly defined also. So we have two positions, fatalism and extolment of human endeavor, but more typical of discussions of this kind is a compromise position, like the one expressed in the following quotation, number 6, and there we also have a couple of other very similar passages, where it says, all humans are confined, restricted by two types of action, divine intervention and the effort wrought by man. There is nothing other than these two. Excellent man, goals are not accomplished through divine intervention alone, nor through human effort by itself. Rather, success comes from the two combined. There is no time now to enter more deeply in these discussions, and we have several, as I said, of them, but at least I hope even the last two quotations should be enough to show that general statements about the fatalism of Indian culture that one can sometimes read in popular literature, and not only in popular literature even, are not only simplified but plainly false, at least if they refer to the whole of the Indian tradition. After this analysis of single passages pertaining to the notion of fate, let us now have a look at two other aspects of the presence of fate in the Mahabharata, prophecies and the dicing game. In the Mahabharata, it is in principle regarded as possible to know the fate in advance, at least in broad terms. Quite a few passages speak of persons that are able to recognize bad omina, so for example, constellations of stars and planets, unusual behavior of animals, strange natural phenomena, etc., or have in some other supernatural way gained knowledge about the future, and hence can and do predict upcoming events. But interestingly, these prophecies seem to be somehow extraneous to the run of the story. There is probably not a single example of a protagonist who changed his plans on getting to know predictions of that kind, even if their explicit aim is to warn him. But on a, so to speak, smaller scale, we find prognostic practices, like the prediction of auspicious times for certain rituals or generally actions, etc., and even court astrologers are mentioned, though probably only in later parts of the text, at least that's my feeling. And I would like to end the main part, at least, of my talk with mentioning a very special way in which fate probably is present at a crucial moment of the plot, namely during the dicing game, in which Yudhishthira loses all to Duryodhana. You remember when, after this petition, Duryodhana challenges Yudhishthira to a dicing game. And I can't even begin to explain the numerous intricate problems that are connected with the interpretation of this event. It's, of course, very crucial for the whole story. Let me just indicate two of the most important ones. First, the setting of this game may be modeled on a certain, well, this is almost certain, I would say, on a ritual in which dicing occurs and the outcome of the throws is thought to be the result of the intervention of divine powers. If this is true, Yudhishthira's defeat, because he loses, will be a kind of religious act and a direct work of divine fate. But, and here is the second problem, unfortunately, the rules of this game are not entirely clear. So we don't even know exactly how big the part of skill is. It has been proposed, for example, that luck plays no role at all. Moreover, the person who gambles on Duryodhana's behalf, this is his uncle Shakuni, so he challenges Yudhishthira, but he does not play himself. This is one of one additional problem. This person is more than once accused of cheating. So even when theoretically there should be an element of luck, in practice it may be excluded by his cheating. But, well, in spite of these doubts, the extraordinary number of explicit references to fate, mostly Daiva is used in these cases, by all the persons involved in the game, so by Duryodhana, by his uncle, the gambler, professional gambler, by Dhritarashtra, the old king who has to give assent to the event, and last but not least by Yudhishthira, who also has to accept the challenge. So that means if he would not have accepted the challenge, the game would not have taken place. So the fact that all these persons very often refer to fate in this context show, I think, that fate in fact plays a decisive role at least in the lead up to the dicing, which in turn is the reason for everything that follows, one can say, including the war. Now only very short epilogue remains. Though I promised not to delve deeply into philosophical questions, I must at least mention one well-known element of classical Indian thinking that is of major importance for the notion of fate, the doctrine of karma and retribution. In its strict form, the karma doctrine affects in a fundamental way the notion of fate, because according to that belief, what we are and what happens to us ultimately is nothing but the mechanical effect, as it were, of our own deeds, right? And this is obviously incompatible with the understanding of fate as an independent entity that emerged from the passages most of the passages at least I discussed today. But the implicit tension between these two views on fate or on what we are and what we experience is not only not resolved in the Mahabharata, it is hardly ever directly addressed. And the probable explanation for this state of affairs is that the two doctrines have their origin in two different milieus. Whereas the old notion of fate, found in the formulae presented today, was common in the warrior and court circles in which heroic epic theory thrived, karma conceptions were developed among Brahmins and ascetics and entered the Mahabharata mostly in the didactic portions. The transformation, or should I say, abolition of the traditional notion of fate is a process that only begins in the Mahabharata, therefore. And here I must finally mention the Bhagavad Gita, the most famous part of the Mahabharata, where Krishna adds a whole new dimension to this process by explaining to Arjuna, the middle brother of the five Pandavas, the concept of action without attachment. But this is exactly where I would like to stop today. So thank you very much for your patience and attention.